Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Dave Pablo. Today, correspondent Megan Marone talks with award-winning artist Brenda Ann Keneally.
We're also covering a recent public forum meeting that could have a serious impact on immigration enforcement in the area.
Then we will talk with Susan Zimmet, the author of a new book on the successful struggle a century ago to win women the right to vote in the United States.
Afterwards, we'll talk about cryptocurrency with local enthusiast Franklin Marin.
Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
On Wednesday night, the Rensselaer County Legislature held its monthly public forum despite snowy weather conditions. The legislature had considered making a statement against Sheriff Patrick Russo's application seeking 287G funding from the Department of Homeland Security. Under the arrangement, Rensselaer County would be the first in New York State to collaborate with federal ICE agents. A rally protesting against 287G funding in front of the Rensselaer County building was canceled due to weather-related safety concerns. The sheriff was not present at the forum, where legislators heard comments from members of the public. We'll hear more on this later in the show.
The Troy Record reports that on Thursday, Mayor Patrick Madden appointed Brian Owens to the permanent as the permanent replacement for retired Chief John Tedesco. This comes just 3 months after Madden promoted Owen to assistant chief. Owen is a graduate of the FBI Academy and a 14-year veteran of the U.S. Army Reserve.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation will host a public meeting about a habitat management plan for the Capital District Wildlife Management Area in the towns of Berlin and Steventown. The meeting will be held at 6:30 p.m. Thursday, February 22nd, at the Berlin Volunteer Fire Company, 11 Community Ave.
The House voted early Friday to reopen the federal government after a five-hour shutdown and passed a $400 billion budget deal, overcoming opposition from both liberal Democrats and conservatives to endorse enormous spending increases, especially for the military, despite looming trillion-dollar deficits. Senator Rand Paul briefly forced a government shutdown in protest over the huge increase in the deficit. Many Democrats in the House voted against the deal, due to a lack of action on immigration reform.
Actress Diane Neal, who played an assistant district attorney on Law & Order SVU, announced this week she is running for Congress in the Hudson Valley's 19th district, which includes most of Rensselaer County. Democrats are worried her independent bid could help Republican first-term incumbent John Faso. He's considered vulnerable. Neal told the Daily Freeman, "I'm a little libertarian, I'm a lot liberal, mostly progressive."
President Donald Trump has paid tribute to outgoing White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter, who quit this week amid domestic abuse allegations. Quote, "We wish him well," Trump said. "He worked very hard." His comments came a day after a White House spokesman said they could have better handled the accusations. It is alleged Mr. Porter gave one ex-wife a black eye while another filed a restraining order. Porter has been dating Hope Hicks, the White House communication director.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Next, who are you? What do you want to do and be in the finite amount of time we are each given on this planet Earth? These universal existential questions are at the heart of a new project by Brenda Ann Keneally, the award-winning photographer, Guggenheim Fellow, Pulitzer Prize nominee, and formerly incarcerated youth who happened to grow up in Albany and Troy. WOOC correspondent Megan Marone sat down with Brenda to discuss her new project, Scrappin' in New York State. This is part two of an extended conversation with board members of a little creative class, Brenda's nonprofit youth arts and education organization.
Hi, I'm Brenda Ann Keneally. My current bio is headed by the line digital folk artist and current founder of a little creative class, a nonprofit youth arts organization located here in beautiful Maspeth, Queens, with a counterpart in North Troy, New York. And this is the vice president of the aforementioned organization.
Hello, my name is Don Scheer. I'm vice president of A Little Creative Class, currently living in Miami, Florida, and I'm transposed here to beautiful Massapet.
And we have another board member here, Simon.
Hello, my name's Simon. I'm a board member, mentor, resident son, and contributor.
Simon, Don, Brenda, could you all explain what A Little Creative Class is?
Well, it's a free creative residency or artist residency for what I call first-generation creatives. I was born and grew up in Albany, New York, and parts of Troy, and no one in my family pursued a creative field. I was an artist. I kind of saved my life by reciting poetry in my head, and then through a bunch of hitchhiking adventures, eventually became a photographer. And as I lived in certain neighborhoods, particularly in Miami and Brooklyn, now Queens, they were changed from the times when I got there, living in these cheap places, to really meccas. And the change was usually brought about by people in the creative field. So it was no surprise when I learned that this was an actual term called the creative class. And I started looking into that more and realized that almost none of people that I grew up with or the young people who I had collaborated with in this documentary project, Upstate Girls, were really poised socially or emotionally to take advantage of kind of wider world that a life in the field of arts or science or online publishing or anything that comes under the heading of the creative class, just because it requires a bit of assumption of healthy self-entitlement and comfortability with the wider world that me, my brother, sister, and most of the kids I know, that wasn't really the way our families had raised us. We were taught to be practical, work hard, think totally inside the box. And this upbringing, it was very practical and necessary, however, completely at odds with the way people make money in today's idea-based economy, which is called the creative class. So I had this idea that creativity is almost a class privilege, the freedom to make mistakes and the self-possession that one needs to have the audacity to think that something that you would put forth into the world is going to be received, and then further to be received in a way that is economically and socially viable. And that's where gathering friends of mine with these amazing kind of eyes and lives where they could just see something in a different way than it was presented. Like my friend Don here was one of the original artists on South Beach, Florida, which you hear South Beach now, everybody has certain images of glamour and fashion. Well, when we lived there and I met Don in the late 80s, it was anything but. So maybe Don might want to talk a little bit about how he's seen creativity change places where he's lived and certainly his own life.
Well, I've always been a part of a neighborhood that's pretty much free to live in or more accessible for someone that creates to have a loft. And then it's always taken over by developers who sell the property and make a lot of profit. And the artists are forced to move across the river. It's certainly happened here in New York City, and it certainly happened in Miami.
And Simon, how are you involved in A Little Creative Class, not only as a board member, but also as an educator?
I think of myself as a testament to possibility and opportunity as someone who was on the receiving end of so many opportunities and moments where I can change my life, you know, which often we don't see in the moment, but that you can look back on. And they are certainly palpable and tangible moments, especially for those who are coming from a long way. And by that, I mean, you know, coming from nothing, having big opportunities means a lot more. And so really, what I think is my most instrumental or most useful purpose in being a part of this is to be an encouraging force that shows that, yeah, opening yourself up to new experiences and thinking outside the box and kind of sticking it to the man or allowing yourself to join these ranks of people who are migrating from place to place and creating new economies and creating new cultures and communities. There's a way to play alongside and open up your own opportunities for your own communities, where you come from and who you represent.
Can you talk about the metaphor for first generation college college students and the whole social acclimation?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that there are particular barriers and conversations and opportunities that need to come about in order for lasting change, I think, to take effect. And part of that is ensuring a quality education. And that, you know, phrase is thrown around a lot, but really what that means is having a college degree and being on the same competitive level in this field of competitive education that exists, being on the same level as everyone else and being able to speak on the same platform and being able to access the same language. And so I'm very interested in helping those for whom college has been nothing but a scene in a movie take advantage of and help become a practical reality that does fit within practical game plan for someone's family.
You know, we talk a lot about opportunity. We talk a lot about, like Simon said, go to college, get a good job. Those are just phrases. And the points that lead up to that and the stumbling blocks, I always think it's like there's that scene in the Bible where there's someone speaking in tongues and everyone of all different languages can understand it and it's with a single language. I think of these phrases that are sort of the pull yourself up by your bootstraps American dream phrases as like that in reverse. You know, go to college is like telling someone pre-map or GPS day, you know, to go across the country and they have, yes, they would like to be there, but they have no idea what the practical steps are. There's an assumption that everyone would know the language, just even the practical preparation that takes place all the way back, you know, probably in kindergarten, and families for whom that's a given and part of their culture and the landscape of their lives, it just begins effortlessly and it's assumed. And then once even those practical step-by-step hurdles are jumped, it's the same way for getting a job or any kind of achievement, kids that I know are just not emotionally prepared because it's overwhelming. And then it is like walking into a room where you hear all kinds of different languages spoken, and it's hard to even focus in on one. And so leaving your family for the first time, other people talking about vacations to places whose names you've never even heard or knew existed. Certain kind of inside information that feels like you're trying to access a world that is completely foreign to you, yet it's not. And you're doing this all alone and all on your own. So there's tremendous supports. So lots of kids, even looking at the new businesses in downtown Troy, they're beautiful. Kids that I know say, oh, those rich people. They really don't even have a language for what separates them from the rest of the world, certainly the new economy. So it's just best to stay away and best to sort of internalize that that's not for me.
Let's get into what you guys actually do with young people.
Well, we have each student create a scrapbook about their beginning, their life, their family, where they come from. It's very emotional. We have therapists there to help counsel them. That's one reason I wanted to be involved. I think I enjoy counseling as much as an art teacher. We do teach them creative skills. That's where I come in because my life has always been making things out of nothing and turning it into some income. So we try to inspire their creative interest and teach them the skills to actually sell their product. The scrapping is the beginning of it all.
That was WOOC correspondent Megan Marone in part two of an extended discussion with artist Brenda Ann Keneally in her new project with youth in Troy called Scrappin' in New York State. Please visit alittlecreativeclass.org for more information. Students from Troy's ALP School 12 will begin scrapbooking with Brenda and her team of mentors on February 26th, and they will be showcasing their work at the Rensselaer County Historical Society, film festivals, and the People's History Museum in summer 2018.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Our next segment features Susan Zimmet, author of Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote.
We're talking with Susan Zimmet, who is the author of Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. Now, many people know that in 2020, we'll be celebrating the 100th year of women getting to right to vote nationally. But apparently in New York State, Susan, women won that right to vote earlier?
Well, basically what ends up happening is after a amendment is made to the Constitution in New York, in the country, after the Congress votes for it, then it has to go and be ratified by 3/4 of the states in order for it to actually become a law in the and a change to the Constitution. And so after it did get passed, then they had to first go out and get the 3/4 of the state. So there's different time frames of when each state voted to give women the right to vote. And 2020 is when the 37th state finally voted, which was Tennessee, and got us the right to vote.
Now, is New York easier than other states in terms of getting a right to vote? And certainly some of the lead-in, I guess, advocates for women's suffragette were from New York.
Well, many of the suffragists and many of the leaders of the movement were from New York, and a lot of it started in New York. There's no doubt about that. But actually, most of the Western states actually gave women the right to vote much quicker than the Eastern states. And actually, New York wasn't that easy. It had been up for ratification 3 years prior, and it actually failed. However, when it did finally come back in 1917, when New York State finally did pass it the second time, that really was sort of the tip of the iceberg that pushed the rest of the states to fall in line. But no, actually, the Western states were much more proactive in terms of giving women the right to vote very early on. A lot of states gave women the right to vote before we nationally won the right to vote, before the before Congress even voted to give us the right. And what happened was a lot of states, when they were first settling out west, they didn't have a lot of women. And so a lot of these states felt, first of all, that the women who did go with them to settle these states, that, you know, they worked just as hard as the men did to get out there and help settle the states. And they felt that they couldn't deny them the right to vote. But also, they wanted to get more women to move out there because there were so many men and so few women. So they felt if they advertised women would have the right to vote in the state, that they might get more women to move out there. So Western states actually were the head of the curve, and the Eastern states were the last states to join, which is surprising in today's day and age when you sort of think about it.
Now, when the Western states were given women the right to vote at an earlier stage, did that also mean more equality for women in other aspects of the law, such as property ownership?
I suspect they had a lot more rights because they went out there and they were given rights, basically, so they would move there and be part of there. So, yes.
Now, I think most people alive today, you know, 100 years ago, women got the right to vote. It would sort of be incredible to people to think that you were denying a woman the right to vote. But, in fact, this was a very, very long fight, was it not?
It was a 70-year fight, but what would really amaze people more was not so much the right to vote. What would amaze people is that less than 90 years ago, women basically couldn't even speak in public. Women were owned by their husbands for all intents and purposes. When a woman married a man, she became his property. He could beat her and she had no recourse. She couldn't go to the police. There was no recourse. He could do whatever he wanted. If he wanted to take their child away and give it to the woman down the street, he could do that. If a woman did work, the money belonged to her husband and he could drink it, you know, and basically spend the money whatever way he wanted. If a woman inherited money from her husband, from her father, it became her husband's money. Women had no rights. Women couldn't go, girls didn't go to school. You know, they were only taught basically some of the basics, but they were expected to, at 13, 14, 15 years old, get married, have kids, take care of their husband, take care of their children, and not go out and work and not basically, you know, be involved politically in any way whatsoever. I think that's what's even more shocking is the fact of how few rights women actually had. And what ended up happening was the women that really led the charge on the woman's right to vote were really, it all came out of abolitionists. They were trying to actually get slavery abolished and get, you know, black men and women equal status. And so what happened was when a lot of these suffrage women, they weren't suffragists at the time, they were anti-abolitionists, and they would go and fight for, you know, freedom for, you know, slaves, they were not allowed to speak at a lot of these meetings. They were denied a lot of basic rights. And so at an anti-slavery conference in England, a worldwide anti-slavery convention, the women were not allowed to speak. Even the women who traveled across the ocean, who were delegates to go speak, who we have now were starting to speak in America, weren't even allowed to be a part of it. They got sent and they had to sit upstairs behind a curtain. And that's where Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott started to talk. They met each other and said, wait, we've got no rights. What are we doing? And that's when they started to fight for their own rights. And so the right to vote came out of these women coming together to hold a convention on equal rights for women. And they were looking to have equal pay if they worked, to have control over their body, to be able to speak in public. The right to vote was not a part of this whole entire movement, but Elizabeth Cady Stanton had realized that women would really, truly not have any real freedom unless they had political freedom, which meant the right to vote. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote into this Declaration of Sentiments that they were holding a convention about the right to vote. Actually, a lot of the women who were for equal rights thought by giving women the right to vote would make them look ridiculous and people would laugh at them. And actually, at the convention, Frederick Douglass, who was the only black man to be there, stood up and said to the women, without this right, you really truly don't have rights. And he convinced the women to vote, to add the right to vote into the Declaration of Sentiments. Ultimately, that's what we know the Declaration of Sentiments to be all about, is the right to vote, and that's ultimately what we got. But we still, as women, do not have equal rights in the Constitution. The only right we have protected in the Constitution as women is the right to vote. There were three constitutional amendments that were done to give black men equal rights above and beyond the right to vote. So women don't even realize how easily their rights could be eroded if, God forbid, our government became even more aggressive than our existing government is today. Well, we should be scared. I mean, when we look at today's government and we look at what's being said, and you hear some of the things that are coming out of some of the senators and congresspeople, I mean, most recently, I think it might have been a state senator most recently said that women getting raped and incest was basically God's will. So when you have people who really believe that type of thing, if we get more and more of those people in office, women have no clue how fast their rights could be lost in America.
In the late 70s and 80s, I remember the fight over trying to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, was ultimately defeated. Ironically, Illinois was one of the states that actually sort of sealed its fate. But I haven't heard much these days about the fight over the Equal Rights Amendment.
Actually, no, interestingly enough, and I'm doing a lot of work on that also, the Equal Rights Amendment's 100th anniversary will be 2023. Now, we haven't passed it yet, and hopefully we can pass it by 2023, but that's when Alice Paul actually introduced it, had gotten it introduced into Congress, and it was actually introduced by by Susan B. Anthony's nephew, actually introduced the Equal Rights Amendment. And so 2023 will be the 100th anniversary of an amendment that hopefully will get passed if we can really sort of, you know, gear ourselves up and keep working on it. I think right now, this moment in time, with the Me Too movement, with everything that's been going on with, you know, Trump, with all the sexual abuse and all the kind of things, women coming out in droves. I mean, this year alone, 26,000 women applied to Emily's List, which is a political organization that helps pro-choice women run for office. 26,000 women have applied to them to get training for running for office. And so never before have you had more women engaged than you do now. And I think at this moment in time, if we start really working on the Equal Rights Amendment to try to get that passed, I think we have a pretty good chance because of the environment right now.
So we're talking to Susan. You mentioned it took a 70-year campaign to win the woman's right to vote. What were some of the, you know, interesting tactics that, in fact, women resorted to over those 7 years?
Well, I think a lot of things that people don't know is that actually the suffragette movement was the first time civil disobedience was ever employed. It had never been employed before. But this was the second phase of the movement, because the movement was really two phases. You had the Susan B. Anthony and you had the Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, in the very beginning years, Lucretia Mott, you know, and all those women who were going, you know, speaking at different places, trying to educate people, going door to door, doing petitions. But then what happened was in the second phase, Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who were much younger, had been in England. They saw the radicalization of the suffragists in England and what they were doing and how they chose to, like, actually do some actual violence. You know, they were breaking windows and, you know, defacing government property and whatever. And they really took it to an extreme. And Lucy Burns and Alice Paul got arrested in England. When they came back to America and saw how long the suffragists were fighting to get, you know, the right to vote and how they weren't really getting very far and how very few states were approving it, they started going to very radical means. And that's when they started to do the civil disobedience. They did civil disobedience. There were peaceful protests, but the president of the country didn't like it and whatever. And then because we ended up entering into World War I and the women would not stop protesting, they started to arrest them. So the women got arrested. And some of these women were actually congressional wives. Some of these women had actually been at the White House to have dinner. And these women got arrested. They got thrown into god-awful, horrific prisons, some of them that had been closed down forever, that were rat-infested, that were cold, that were disgusting. They got, you know, physically and, you know, abused. And then they went on hunger strikes, and then the women ended up getting force-fed, which was a very, very, very dangerous thing. You know, and a lot of them could have died, and a lot of them, their health was really, really put at risk because of the hunger strikes and stuff. So it was really the abuse of the women just for asking for their right to vote. That really, to me, is really the most astounding thing about the movement, that our own government, our own president, basically turned the forces of government against their own women just because they were asking for a right and they were doing it peacefully.
So, Susan, can you remind us again of the full name of the book? And, you know, where do you get it? And also we'll just finish up with, so we are coming up to one century for the national right of women to vote. Any particular observations or celebrations are going to take place that people should be aware of?
Okay, well, the book is Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. It's published by Viking Publishing, Random House, which is very exciting to have a book published by that amazing publishing house. The book is available anywhere. I mean, you can go into any bookstore and hopefully they'll have it or they'll order it for you. You can get it, of course, through Amazon or any other kind of online thing. You can get it through Barnes & Noble's online. What's been very, very exciting about the book is the reviews that we've been getting have been outstanding. We have been getting the most spectacular reviews that I can't believe. And we just most recently today, I was told about 11 books that are must-reads for people, you know, who are interested in the Women's March, and ours is one of the 11 books. So that's exciting. 2020 is the 100th anniversary. I am actually on the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission in New York State, and, you know, we're constantly every year planning different events and stuff, and hopefully we'll have a major celebration in New York State and all over the country for the 100th anniversary to basically celebrate our right to vote, but more importantly, to basically let the world know that we're here, and we're never going to go back, and we're never going to shut up, and we're never going to sit down quietly and not speak out.
And that was Susan, and this is Mark Dunley with WOOC.
That was Susan Zimmet on the women's suffrage movement and what it means today.
For those just tuning in, I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Eric Newton. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Cryptocurrency seems to be everywhere these days. Media outlets are covering the ups and downs of Bitcoin just as closely as NASDAQ and the Dow. But what exactly is a cryptocurrency, and how does it work? I sat down with local enthusiast Franklin Marin to discuss.
Hi, Franklin. Thanks for joining me. We're here to talk today about cryptocurrencies, which are a big subject in the media, but not a lot of people know what they are, how they work, and what exactly the big deal is. What most people are hearing about are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Ripple, and they're all very popular, but what is it exactly that people do with them?
Okay, so Bitcoin, which is like the grandfather, it wasn't the first, but it's the most popular. What happens is that it's based on an algorithm that keeps track of a ledger. A ledger, or a blockchain as is more commonly referred to, is just a long book of transactions. And more or less what Bitcoin does is that it allows you to exchange something as if it was a dollar or gold or whatever, or even in the old days, a sheep, and it gives a certain value, and you exchange it between one person and another. And unlike, let's say, credit cards or any kind of banking type system where there's a third party that oversees the transaction, cryptocurrencies allow the two parties to be the ones that are managing the transactions, and a third, fourth, or fifth party to be the ones that validate the transaction. So, for example, I give you some Bitcoin, you provide whatever service or whatever item, and everybody else included in the blockchain verifies that transaction for, security, and also to make sure that there's no fraudulent transactions. In other words, that I don't use that same Bitcoin and give it to somebody else.
Right.
So okay. It eliminates that part of the corruption or the fraud of it. Whereas a credit card, if it gets stolen, you can shop here, shop there, and never pay it off. Cryptocurrency has inherent transaction monitoring / security where everybody else not doing the transaction validates the authenticity of your transaction.
Got it. Now, it's not like a common hard currency like dollars or euros or something like that, though. As far as I understand, it can only be used between people on their computers. Is that right?
Yes, to a certain extent, on any digital format. So you can use it on your computers. You can use it on your smartphones. You can also, in certain places, you can use it on your smartwatches. Just like you would use like your MasterCard to swipe at a you know, insert a fast food chain at the iPay or the Google Pay. There are systems in certain places where you can use cryptocurrencies. Of course, the most popular one is Bitcoin. But yes, you can use that and hold your Bitcoins if you want, either on a physical wallet or paper wallet, or a software wallet. Mm-hmm. And each one has different levels of security and functionality with it.
Right. Well, I think one issue that people have with cryptocurrency is they say, well, sure, there's a few places I can use it, but what do I really use it for once I have it? What's the argument for it being more useful than cash? Or is it more of like a specialized thing?
Right now, it's specialized. But the reason that people are excited about it is that it is what's called a peer-to-peer currency. So in cryptocurrency, more or less, you've taken out the banks. There's not going to be a service charge to the banks. There's no sudden, I went to this ATM and I got charged $10, but I went to this other ATM and I got charged $20. It's a decentralized, which means there's no one governing body. But because it's peer-to-peer, it means everybody controls and watches over everybody else's transactions. So that's what people are liking about it, is that, number one, it's encrypted, it's secure. The transactions are only recorded from wallet to wallet, but nobody knows who that person is. So it's not unlike credit cards, where they keep track of your Social Security and where you bought and whatever. It doesn't know. It just went from this wallet to that wallet, and all the wallets are encrypted and secured. So it's private.
I see. The other way of acquiring these cryptocurrencies that you mentioned was mining.
Yes.
Could you explain that? Because it seems a bit counterintuitive that you're mining a virtual currency.
Okay, so the word is mining, and that's the term that everybody has accepted. But you're not mining anything. What you're doing is that you're using a CPU, a specialized CPU, for example, Bitcoin's, it's a special called ASIC CPU that is designed specifically for that coin.
Right.
The algorithm that's at the foundation of this coin.
Right. To back up, a CPU is the central processing unit
of your computer. But you don't want to use those because those are limited to depending on to maybe 2-4 cores. Now, something that came into the market was a GPU, a graphics processing unit. The graphics processing unit can have anywhere between 1,500 nowadays or maybe only 1,000 to 3,000 cores. Each core you set to work at solving that algorithm.
I see. And your coins are the reward for solving a mathematical algorithm.
Right. And so you solve this. It's like solving prime numbers, for lack of a better example. Scientists are always trying to find the next prime number. And so you're using your computer's graphic powers from your graphics card mostly. You can use your CPU, but you're going to get less results than a graphics processor. So you're going to use your graphics card, and you're going to solve these algorithms. And in solving these algorithms, you're verifying other people's transactions. And each transaction is a new number that's added to the blockchain. That's why they call it a chain, because you solve a block. And it becomes a blockchain, and that's just a long string of transactions. And it keeps on growing, and it keeps on growing. So inherently, the mining becomes difficult because now you got to solve more, bigger and bigger, longer ledger. So right now, it's exciting because people are discovering new coins that are profitable, so to speak, and that they're somewhat easy to solve as far as the algorithm.
Right.
Or the next number in the sequence.
So that by joining onto the blockchain, it's less work for the computer that you're using, and you get a higher reward for it.
Well, you're always going to get, because it's decentralized, everybody gets a percentage of what work. Right now, as proof of work, there's two terms. They're kind of high tech. I'm not going to really go into them, but there's two types. There's proof of stake. It's proof of work. And just briefly, proof of stake means how much do you own of a coin. And depending on how much you own of a coin, that's how much you get paid. Proof of work, which is the more popular one right now, is how much work, how many graphics cards do you put to work, you'll get a percentage of every transaction. So when I give you a Bitcoin, let's say we were trading something that worthy, because right now it's, $8,000 at this point in time. But if I give you a Bitcoin, 1% at least of that transaction goes out to pay the people who verify the transaction.
Okay.
And so if I was one of those people that was verifying your transactions because I left my computer running all day, and I don't get to pick which transactions, I don't know whose transactions I'm verifying, I'm just verifying transactions.
Right.
I get paid a percentage. And so people have pooled together their computers through the internet to join what's called mining pools. Mm-hmm. Because then all these people together and all their CPUs and all their GPUs together are able to process these transactions faster than you doing it by yourself. If you do it by yourself, let's say it would take maybe a month or two to process one transaction, whereas if you join a pool that's for that currency that you want to mine, you're doing it with thousands of people, and you're processing all these transactions with thousands of people and whatever they have set up. So it's once again, it's peer-to-peer, and it's like charging a commission or a fee. You're charging, 2%, 1%, depending on the coin. Some coins charge up to 2%, 3%, 5%. That's why they call it proof of work. You do the work. You have proof of it, you validate the work, and you get, and that's how people get paid.
Okay.
And that money, or that percentage, gets put into what I mentioned before, is a wallet.
Gotcha. Okay. So if we go back to the wallets, you mentioned there were three kinds. There were the paper, the digital, and then a physical one.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about the difference between them?
Okay, the three different types of wallet, basically. Physical just means, because each wallet is a long line of encrypted numbers and letters. Mm-hmm. It'll be, random number generator, letters, symbols, depending on the type of wallet, it's how long it is. And so in order for it to be secure, some wallets are made out of passphrases. So, for example, one wallet that I have uses 25 different words, random words, to back up my as my passphrase to back up my wallet. So if I ever lose contact with my wallet, I have the 25 passwords that count as passphrase to be able to go anywhere and say, okay, these are my passphrases, and they'll say, oh, okay, that's associated with this wallet, so I can access my wallet. If I lose that paper with the passphrases, I've lost access to my wallet. And let's say I lose wherever else I have it. So that's called the physical wallet, where you keep it on a piece of paper somewhere secure. That's called the paper wallet, where you keep it on some physical printout or something like that. And you have to keep that secure somewhere.
Gotcha, like in a locked safe
something. A locked safe or something, because in case you ever lose it on your computer. So that's a backup, to paper backup to a wallet.
Okay.
Then there's a software wallet that you can load on your desktop. Some of them have accessibility to it on your desktop and on your cell phone, or different places like that. Depending on your operating system, they'll have different versions. And then that's just a piece of software that you open. You input your wallet information, you input your passphrase. Once again, you can back it up to like a paper or a printout that you save somewhere just in case. And that's where that wallet resides. And then whenever you need to make a transaction, you just need to be able to open up that piece of software.
Okay.
And then the third one is a hardware wallet, where you have a physical like key fob or something that goes on your keychain, where whenever you want to store coins on it, you have to plug it into your computer, open up whatever interface it has with that wallet, and it downloads or transfers the information of what it's in your wallet to that physical. And then when you disconnect, that's the only place that you have your currency.
So it would look just like a general flash drive stick?
Yes. Okay. Most of them are compatible, or they'll have a cable that's like a flash drive stick.
I see.
And that connects to like a USB port.
Excellent. Again, thank you so much for joining me. This has been super informative, and I think you've answered basically every question I could possibly think of about cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
So thank you again, Franklin Marin.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear more pieces about technology, let us know on Twitter. That's right, we now have a Twitter. Follow us at WOOC1053FM.
At Wednesday night's public forum at the county legislature, Troy residents Norm McDowell and Alexander Ferrer spoke out against the proposed 287G funding application that Sheriff Patrick Russo had sought from the Department of Homeland Security. Under the arrangement, Rensselaer County would be the first in New York State to collaborate with federal ICE agents. After the forum, WOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer spoke to county legislator Peter Grimm.
My name is Nora Higgins McDowell, and I am a resident of Rensselaer County, along with my husband, Ton Wing, and my children, Irene and Rufus Wing McDowell, who are second generation in this country. My husband came to this country with the fall of Saigon as an immigrant from Vietnam. In the midst of a war, in the midst of fear of immigrants, there were wonderful people who helped his family of two adults and six children. This country is blessed because those people helped my husband, his five siblings, and his parents. Folks, we need to be welcoming in Troy. We need to be welcoming in Rensselaer County. We do not want 287G. We do not want me to worry that my husband has to make sure his passport is in order, because it might be hard to prove that he is a citizen. It's white privilege that I don't have to worry about getting picked up. I've had friends who've gotten picked up, been in this country 30 years, worked on Troy houses, built our community. Our immigration system is broken. It's broken so bad that we can't even pass a federal budget. My colleagues, my neighbors, the restaurants I love to go to, the food I eat that is picked in Rensselaer County and comes to the farmer's market. Those are the people being targeted by this. Those are the people who may get caught up in a dragnet. It matters in the city of Troy. It matters in rural and suburban Rensselaer County. That is why I'm asking you to say no to 87G. We don't say why people joined the Nazi party around the time in Germany. We don't say whether they were good Nazis or just worried about their job or just trying to figure out a way to fill a prison that's too big for the people who actually live in this city. We call them Nazis. We're at that time in our period of history. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for my kids that we're at that time. But we are at that time, and we have to make those kind of decisions. And we have to put the brakes on fascism wherever we can, and especially in our local communities in our county. So that is why I, Nora McDowell, mother of Irene and Rufus Wing McDowell, say no to 87G. And that is why many of my neighbors are here, trudging through the snow. Because the local is where the neighborhoods are, is where the people are connected to each other. And we have to take care of each other.
Thank you, Ms. McDowell.
My name is Alexander Ferrer, and I just wanted to briefly say that my father fought for this country in the armed forces. His brothers fought for this country in the armed forces. Most of my cousins fought in the Army or the Marines for this country. And a lot of them fought alongside Mexican Americans and Dominican Americans and Cuban Americans and a lot of diverse people. And that's the way that it should be, and that's what makes America special. And when you have a president that is talking the way he is, making racial slurs left and right, and deporting, the other day, a gentleman that was here at 50 years of age and has been and was here since he was 10 years old, has no criminal record whatsoever, has a family, has a wife, and you deport him, you send a very clear message that government can't be trusted and that bigotry is on the increase. And that is not America. And that should never be America. Everyone is important and everyone adds to this country. And the sheriff's office should not be involved in ICE. We already have the president holding the Dreamers hostage. We don't need to be involved in his nonsense. And we don't need to be involved in supporting a president that fires the FBI director and tries to fire the other one that thinks he's above the law. He's saying, look at these people, pay attention to these people, let's get rid of these people. But if anybody looks at me, I want them fired. America was not founded on one person is bigger than the country. We need to basically support our neighbors. God said, respect our neighbors, welcome our neighbors, work with our neighbors. They want to work with us. And it is a humongous stereotype to put them in the context of this president in terms of they're all criminals. That is nonsense. That is nonsense. We would have deported all Italian people who said they're all in the mob. But we don't say that because we know it's not true. It's also not true that all of these people come here and are part of some type of gang. They come here to work. They come here to get a good education and to help their families out to the very best of their ability. And they're also doctors, lawyers, teachers, and there are in our military right now. Even if they're not citizens, some of them are serving in our armed forces.
One more minute.
So we need to really rethink this and put this on Trump and not on the citizens of Rensselaer County to be part of this movement that basically stereotypes people and creates a hostile environment for our city. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
What are the options for preventing this from happening, if any?
Well, where we are right now is it hasn't happened. It's still in the application process. All right, the sheriff has signed off on it. He has sent it to ICE or to the feds. And they have not approved the application yet. That could happen tomorrow. Could happen a month from now. You know, I don't know what the process is on the federal level. If it happens, then we take a different step. Then we have to urge him to stop it. He can stop it at any time. Even if it's put in place, it can be stopped. So, I mean, this is great enthusiasm tonight. I mean, if that continues, I don't know if he's going to ever have a public hearing on this. You know, and we don't have the jurisdiction to tell him he can't do this. He's elected by the people as we are. So, and he has the right to manage his department as he does. And I think he does a fine job. I hate to see that he's doing this, but, you know, this is what happens. I mean, if we had a lot of people here tonight, maybe the majority would have had a different response. But this failed in committee today. Mm. The resolution that's supposed to go to the floor Tuesday for a vote failed in committee.
Why? And also, why vote before the hearing where public sentiment is expressed?
Committee is where the resolutions for all the bills that have been drafted go to. Okay, and everything is broken down into committees. There's environmental, there's education, there's, you know, budget and rules and so on and so forth. But what happens in those committees are that it has to pass there to get to the floor. Now, tonight, if there have been enough people here that influenced the other side, the chairman could bring that back Tuesday night. But he's the only one that can bring it back on Tuesday night, as we call a late file.
That was a recording of part of the public forum at the county legislature this past Wednesday. Troy residents spoke out about the proposed 287G funding application that Sheriff Patrick Russo has sought from the Department of Homeland Security.
At the recent NOFA New York Winter Conference, I had a chance to interview many of the vendors, NGOs, and other entities that took a booth in the main hall. Today's segment is a quick look at the National Young Farmers Coalition.
I'm Sophie Akoff. I'm the National Field Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition, and we are based in New York State, down in the Hudson Valley, and so NOFA New York is our home conference. We're a national organization. We have 40 chapters across the country in 28 states, and we're working to change policy to make it easier to start a farm in the U.S.
And what sort of policy things are we talking about?
Yeah. So this year is a farm bill year, so we have a chance every 5 years to make changes to the farm bill as it's reauthorized. And so we've been working to bring farmers to D.C. and to meet with their members of Congress in district to ask for support in the next farm bill. So that's our biggest policy push right now.
Any sense on how that process is going at this point?
Yeah, we're expecting to see a draft of the House Farm Bill in February or perhaps March. So we will have a better sense of what is in it at that point. But we've introduced two marker bills with congressional sponsors that would support young farmers in the Farm Bill, specifically helping with land access and access to USDA credit programs.
So when you say helping with land access, is it basically trying to get funding so it's affordable for people to acquire property, or is it funding for equipment, or all of the above?
Yeah, so there's a program in the Farm Bill called the Farmland Conservation Protection Program. Wait, I'm going to say that again. The Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, ACEP, and it funds land trusts to protect farmland from development. And most of that federal funding is going to easements that protect the land from being developed, but not from going out of production and being sold to a non-farmer. And that's where a lot of the pressure is coming from, that's making land unaffordable to working farmers, is that non-farmers want to buy that land and have second homes and rural estates and all that. So in the Farm Bill, we're looking to target that federal funding to land trusts who are using stronger easements that ensure the land stays in the hands of working farmers.
And given that both houses and the presidency are occupied by Republicans, have the Republicans been in the past receptive to that type of thing?
Yes, it's a process. Luckily, agriculture is a bipartisan issue. We are really lucky to have support on our bills, our issues from both sides of the aisle. In farmland protection dollars specifically, it's a little bit more challenging because it is, you know, additional funding. But we're building that support.
How long have you been in farming yourself?
Let's see. I started farming in 2011 on my campus farm, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and I moved to the Hudson Valley for my first apprenticeship in 2012, and that's when I got involved with the National Young Farmers Coalition, because it was actually before the last farm bill was coming up for reauthorization, so I wanted to organize farmers in the Hudson Valley to meet with our member of Congress and ask for his support, and luckily he was on the Agriculture Committee and a Republican, so he had a lot of power. Chris Gibson, who's no longer in Congress, and so he helped us win many wins in the 2014 Farm Bill, and I've been working for the National Young Farmers Coalition ever since then, and I'm working with my partner and another business partner to start up a farm next season, so continuing to do agriculture while also organizing.
Where's your farm going to be?
Kingston, New York.
Oh, nice location.
Yeah, we're excited.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
That was Sophie Ackoff of the National Young Farmers Coalition. Stay tuned for more pieces about farming in New York.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Dave Pablo. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.